Hello again, TJ Schwartz here. I'm here with my co-host Lucas Burnley. This is the Edge and Flow podcast. We are having a great time chatting here, and we had to hit the record button because sometimes we forget to do
It's hard, man.
that.
Like, just the conversation starts rolling, especially after we haven't talked for a while, and we realize like we're gonna burn the candle.
Yeah, no kidding.
So
And we were talking about hunting, so that's
yeah.
that immediately just triggers all kinds of stories and excitement. It is that time of year.
Hopefully some of you guys are out doing better than we've done so far.
Yes, certainly.
We were talking about Jim Vanderveld a little bit from HMC Machine, and his feed, like Facebook or Instagram, either, like, just constantly trigger major FOMO.
Yeah, that guy likes hunting.
He likes hunting, and he's like he's actually hunting a lot.
Yeah.
He was like just down in New Mexico, I think, and I mean, so good on you, Jim.
Yeah, I could stand to hunt a little bit more often, that's for sure.
Dude, it's a hard balance, man. I think I struggle with some of it the same way that I struggle around the shop, which is like to do it well requires planning and strategy and like pre-work. And a lot of times, like I'll get pretty close to a season and re like, oh man, I'm gonna go out, right? Or it just is, it feels reactive a lot of times, and I'm trying to get better about that, or like put in a little more time, a little more scouting. But
Commitment.
it's a commitment. Okay, speaking of commitments, you just got back from Blade Show
Blade Trail
West,
West, Salt
Blade
Lake
Show West,
City. Yeah.
Salt Lake. You want to do like a quick like recap rundown?
I will say once again, love the show. I love the show. Weather, I don't know. We're just getting the best luck down there. We did have a like torrential rain pour for a couple hours, but other than that, it's just the autumn time of year in that part of the world is just great. And so I love being down there. And we went into the show and had, I would say a comparable show to the last 2 years we've exhibited, which is great because the last 2 years were awesome. So I don't know that the show is growing, but I don't know that it's shrinking either. And there are some things going on in the industry that have slowed. I know we've talked about in the past. And so I always look at these shows like I'm going to walk in the door. You have this opportunity to do apples to apples because it's like, okay, 12 months ago, we came to the same place and did the same thing. 12 months before that, we came to the same place and did the same thing. And so it can be a bit of a litmus test, I feel, into like just what are the vibes? How many people are coming to shows? How are the other companies doing and stuff? And it feels stable. It feels very stable, which is, I think, a good sign.
Yeah, it's interesting. I had a thought around Salt Lake specifically, which is like over the years we get really trying to be like, okay, this show is like, it's like hyped, right? Like you get a show, all the like makers are there, like collectors, it's like really buzzy. Salt Lake has actually never really had that. It's all one, it's a newer show. But I'm also starting to wonder if the stable element of shows is tying into the fact, like we've talked about the fact that there are a lot of shows right now. If the stability is kind of an element that people are choosing just as like a known quantity, like you really like going to Salt Lake, like it partially the travel, the location, like all of that works for you. When there were less shows, I think you just gear towards like the one that is going to deliver the most value. And so I think like makers at a point kind of started to have having to like really choose, and it's hard. And I think at this point, maybe there's just a little bit of just like, hey, I like going to Texas. You know, they're like, I just want to go to this place and do the show. I'm like, not really going to worry about it if it's like the newest, hottest thing. No idea if that's true. It's just kind of like a sense that I get.
That's 100% my feeling about it. I really like going places that I like to go to because it's one of those things that, well, if you're going to do it, consistency is really good. If you're going to go every year, you better like going there. You know,
you better
what I mean?
Like going. Yeah.
So yeah,
I just see less, like I see customers being willing to miss certain shows. I mean, it is, man. I mean, like you can only do so much. Mm-hmm. And so I think at this point, maybe it's just like, there's a, like a little bit of a lull in the industry in certain areas, compounded with more availability in areas of the industry.
Mm-hmm.
And that kind of is like leading me to that, where it's just like, sometimes slow is okay. Like, I just want to go, you want to see friends, you want to make sales, but it also doesn't have to just be like full, you know, steam ahead. Like,
yeah, for
try
sure.
To like do everything. So nice.
Yeah. It's great. Had a few people didn't go, including you. I was bummed about
that,
but need to get you out there next year.
I'm really trying to figure it out. I feel like we're closer to being able to do shows with consistency. When you and I were talking about a little bit, which is like, seasonal change physically and mentally. Like, so I've been pretty tied to trying to figure out the Kihoku and like working through like production concepts and like working with new employees and new process and all this stuff. And just recently I started to have like the itch for like realizing like, oh, I haven't been doing like custom folders for a while. And for me, I realized that custom folders are directly tied to knife shows.
Yeah.
And where I'm at right now, like I don't feel like I want to go to a show only with my production stuff, and that like I could show up and I could have some like some of the like closer to production pieces, but I wouldn't have custom folders. And it's just like a weird mental thing. And so I think a little bit of shop time, I think we're at a point where I can start to put some focus back on that. And
that's great.
Exciting. Yeah. So,
yeah, I think you are right about the high end folders in a knife show is really kind of, it sucks a lot of the oxygen out of the whole room towards the like small quantity, high value folding knives.
Yep.
It's a focal point for sure. And
well, it's weird. Like, we've talked about this. So originally, like first 7 years I was making knives, it was all fixed blades. I developed my whole customer base based on fixed blades. When I started doing folders, my market kind of exploded, but I realized later that I lost 50% or more of those original customers because they were just fixed blade guys.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't notice it because of so many new customers like kind of coming in.
Mm-hmm.
And so this moment where I was like, oh man, this, it's like feeling really good, but it's reversed. It's like, I'm doing fixed blades again. The fixed blades are selling really well. I'm having a good time. But then all of a sudden I'm like, yeah, but the customers and collectors that I've built over the last decade of folders, I'm not seeing their names as much.
Yeah.
And I just like, I don't know. It's not like, it's a weird thing. Like, it's not like there's a sense of obligation of like, you guys like support us, so I want to do things that like support their interests.
Yeah.
Can't always do all things at once. But like at this point, I think I'm at a point where I can start to like wrap my head around folders again.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah, I think that's a good idea. And I think it's great to have the multimedium ability to do that, you know, to be able to sort of move the crosshairs around and just sort of spread the love. 'Cause there's a lot, I mean, myself, very good example of that being camped in the fixed blade world. You know, it's cool that you have the resources and time that you've put into both folders and fixed blades at this point.
Yeah, that's a good way to look at it. I think for me, they're like, I'm frustrated with myself because I don't feel like I can do both things simultaneously. But maybe that's like an unreasonable expectation for like where I'm at now, just skill wise, output wise, everything else. And so it feels like big levers. It's like, I can do one thing well, and then I have to stop doing that thing to do the other thing.
Yeah.
In an ideal world, there'd be some level of like simultaneous workflow,
mm-hmm.
you know, but, and that's, so maybe that's like, maybe that's coming into the end of the year. Is I think that that'll hopefully start to happen. I don't know.
Yeah, I'm look forward to see that. Yeah,
me too. Okay, any other, like, from Blade West, any other takeaways? So we're thinking like same sizes, like work, like flow of people, all that.
Yeah, I'd say it felt really stable. And Tom Crine came out there for the first time, hung out with him quite a bit.
Oh, that's a bit. That's actually like a, that's kind of like a big get. Mm-hmm. That's a different show. He's never done that show.
Mm-hmm.
You got to hang out some.
Yeah, he brought in a nice setup of some nice show special folding knives that he built, and said he did really well. Loved the show, had a good time, and he won an award, which was really cool to see.
I saw that. Yeah, congrats to Tom. Yeah. What did he got? Best
Mac,
right? Which is machine assisted custom.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. Okay. Which I'm still struggling around the structure of the category.
Yeah. Definitions are hard.
Definitions are hard.
Yeah.
But yeah, all right, cool. What else we got, man? I know that you ran into some machine situations.
Yeah, so we had a bit of an eventful month as far as the machines. So on the X7, it is now 3+ years old. And has not had a single problem, nothing, no issue. Just put oil in the, oiler, and that's about it. And this tool changer totally failed the other day, like 2 weeks ago. It basically was trying to clock. It's a carousel umbrella style. Mm-hmm. It was trying to clock from one tool to the next, and it just stopped halfway in between. And then errors come up. And so, okay, let's see what's going on. We take the covers off. The belt looks pretty hosed because it's a belt. It's got a timing belt between a servo and the carousel drive.
Okay.
To spin it. And so the belt, yeah, that looks loose. That looks like it would probably start skipping, but we should have stopped there and used Occam's razor, which is usually the simplest explanation is the correct one. And I felt the carousel and I'm like, okay, well, we took the belt off and it feels jammed. Is like, that was my sense. Cause I was thinking if the belt's off, it should turn. Right. By hand, and I'm looking, I don't see anything interfering. I'm like, okay, well, maybe the thing jammed and that made the belt start jumping and stretched it out or broke it. And so we take it apart. We almost completely disassemble all the drive assembly. And I find that there's a worm gear in there that drives the carousel turning. And it's super interesting in that there's lobes on the carousel and the worm gear turns and the worm gear has flat spots in the spiral. So when the knobs on the carousel hit a flat spot, it's now indexed into a tool position.
Got it.
And that way it's like, it's rigid and it can't, the servo is no longer trying to keep it in position. It's the worm gear that's in position till it turns again. So we had to disassemble the whole thing to realize the reason it felt jammed is actually functional. And that's the way it's designed, is that you can't move it. The servo can spin the carousel. The carousel can't spin the servo.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, because of the design of the worm gear. And so we did all that disassembly just to confirm that it was just the belt. So we just threw a new belt on and it works perfect. So it was a $3 belt. Gates, it made the belt, had a part number on it. We were able to get it from offroadbelts.com. Because apparently it's a common belt style for oil pumps in like certain applications. And so we threw it on there and ran fine. And then the other thing was, I've always said that the X7 spindle is kind of noisy. And even since almost it was new, it was like, it's just a little bit noisy. And
let's dig into this. Like, because we're used to hearing machine sounds. Is it noisy in like decibel, or is it like making a noise where you're like, that doesn't sound,
it doesn't sound right, it's not overly loud, but it has just like a it's hard to explain, it's just like a little bit of a whine to it. And and it's been getting worse, and nothing, I'm not it's not clear that anything is happening as far as the machine is having issues other than the sound. That's really the only thing. Okay. And so I'm like, well, let's just do a quick inspection since we've done all this. Now I'm kind of in the maintenance mode. So we take the front inspection cover off of the whole spindle stack, right? And look in there. It's belt driven as well, which a lot of spindles are. And that belt, I grab the belt and just manually turn it. The belt sounds like 1,000 Nikes on a brand new basketball court.
Oh,
like it's got the like the each tooth of the timing belt, like, and so it's basically a dry belt. And that's the issue, is the belt looked to be perfect condition, but it's dry, and it's just when you squeaky. Spin a belt like that at 8,000 RPM and it's dry, it's just making like a whine, right? So I went and just bought like a $5 can of belt conditioner, which you use on serpentine belts on cars and stuff. Sprayed that belt, just dead silent. Just completely eliminated the sound.
Okay, it's been there for years. This is great, actually. So when you were initially looking at Sile and we were just discussing like pros, cons, machines. Okay. One of the big things was around service.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Parts availability was like kind of a strong one. So like versus Haas, right? Where anything can be fixed and someone will come fix it, but you're probably using a Haas part. Mm-hmm. So price goes up, but like you would have had a dude come out and fix it pretty quick, probably.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So that's a great first one, because you were able to problem solve and replace part and just make small repair pretty easily. Like that's less effort than it would have been to go through Haas.
Well, and I did want to know, because of that sound, it sounded like it could be bearing failure in the spindle.
Right.
And that's like why I wanted to, but I know there's a belt in there and I know belts whine. And so I was like, please be the belt. But before I took anything apart, I sent Sile an email, because I just said,
okay,
if I wanted to buy a spindle, how much would it be and how long before I could get it? Because before I take this apart, I just want to like emotionally prepare myself for like, what are the results? If the belt is not the issue, it's not being noisy and it's a spindle bearing, what's the deal? So they said they have the spindle stocked in Houston for immediate shipment, and the spindle for this machine would be about $2,900.
Wow.
So if we needed a spindle, it would be probably depending on however fast we want to pay to ship it, basically from Houston. So luckily that was not it, and it was a $5 can of belt conditioner. But that is a notable thing, though. It's an interesting part of the
story. Dude, that's pretty huge. I mean, yeah, it's interesting with the with machines, because it's like it's such an expense. And like for a lot of us, they are unknown quantities, right? Mm-hmm. Like unless you're a trained machinist, unless you really have a lot of experience, that there's always just going to be something that is the potential for error that needs to be fixed or some type of mechanical failure.
Yeah.
But that's like, again, man, pretty strong argument for Sile.
I mean, pretty for cool. yeah,
just good. I mean,
yeah, I mean, a $2 belt is the only thing that's failed on it in thousands of hours.
Yeah, and you were able to figure it out. You run that machine hard. You were able to diagnose it. It made sense when you looked at it. Yeah, that's pretty cool.
Yeah, yeah. But we are having a tool life issue that I wondered that we have not confirmed, but our perimeter machining on MagnaCut, which is like not the chamfer, but the vertical wall, the perimeter. Our tools are breaking down pretty quick on that. And it feels like they're breaking down quicker than they ever have. But it's not chatter. It's chipping, which is causing streaks. And MagnaCut does that worse than most steels, a lot of steels.
Yeah.
So it's not unusual to see that. But I feel like we're seeing it in an increased rate. And so part of the impetus, because I was like, I want to see if I can feel a bearing issue in this spindle, mm-hmm. Because that could, you would think normally you'd see more of like feed forward chatter as opposed to mm-hmm. like the horizontal chipping, but it could be related. So I'm wondering if possibly the stickiness of that belt could have been transferring some vibration, because if you hear a really whiny sound, sound propagates from vibration at a right. really fundamental level.
And you're, I mean, you're running fast. Yeah. So it's not unreasonable to think that like that being translated through fairly small tooling could yeah. Just minorly yeah. you just chip out faster.
Yeah. Yeah. And so we haven't run it since we conditioned that belt. But the next thing I want to do is it's running in a hydraulic holder. Those do wear out. I need to investigate that. I need to check the run out coming out of the holder. And then the other thing is we are buying that particular tool is a very inexpensive tool from Schar's, very inexpensive. And it could be we're seeing tool quality or coating quality issues.
Right. Right.
So, but I wanted to start with like, okay, if it's a spindle,
yeah,
that's start with like worst case before I go chasing my tail.
Well, and just working backwards. Speaking about hydraulic tool holders. So I'm working on the turn right now and dialing in bevels. So you had done all of the original programming on the turn, right? Mm-hmm. So I've got the original fixtures and I had your original program. What is crazy is that when I basically set it up to run on the new Haas, for some reason, when I would run the bevels, even though I could match speeds, I was getting a different result. And I could not for the life of me figure out why. I was having two things. I was getting this like weird gouging, and then the bevels were coming out different. At a point, I'm fairly sure that it actually might be like a rigidity issue. Like there's a chance that the X7 is actually more rigid than the Super Mini. I had to drop, I kind of had to drop like my, like in feet, like my ramp speeds. Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. It was the strangest thing. And it just, I couldn't figure out. I'm like, we know this works. It's a proven program.
Mm-hmm.
Why doesn't it work here? So I've been like tweaking it, but in that process, one of the things that I changed to, I was like, okay, maybe running ER collets is like part of the problem. Like maybe they flex more. And so I switched to a hydraulic tool holder. I think I had fixed the majority of the problem, but I noticed an instant improvement in surface finish.
Yeah.
It was pretty shocking with the hydro. Yeah.
Yeah. From what I read, that for surface finish, they're one of the best holders you can have, because in counterintuitively, they actually do flex more than the other holders.
Uh-huh.
But in a finishing pass, that actually makes it smoother, because
it
has almost like a microscopic suspension in the tool.
Okay, that makes sense. Because of how it's held.
Because it's held with hydraulic pressure.
It's held with hydraulic pressure. So that's the explanation. It's like a shock absorber as opposed to maybe being super rigid.
Yeah.
Right. You're going down a dirt road, you want suspension.
Yep. And that's where I've read that if you want to do like heavy roughing where you are going to risk like a lot of tool deflection, you really don't want to run a hydro. But I will contest that we aren't really doing any heavy roughing in anything we make.
Heavy to us is like different.
Yeah.
I think like what we consider heavy is not industry heavy.
Yeah. And it's counterintuitively, I think a lot of the like quote unquote heavy milling is aluminum, which is counterintuitive, but in aluminum, it's all about material removal rate.
Right.
And you get a big old cutter and you get to plunge it in there deep and you start hogging like mud bogging through that aluminum.
Right.
And so like horsepower and rigidity, it's like, even though aluminum is a softer material, it is where you see a lot of limits, because the tool can handle a huge amount of engagement because the aluminum machines so well, meaning you need a spindle that can turn it through that.
Right.
Whereas steel, if you try to do that heavy of a roughing, the tool is just not going to survive.
Yeah.
By and large.
Yeah. God, there's so much to learn, man.
Yeah.
It's just stuff's like endless.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think I baby everything for the most part. Like I looked at your feeds and speeds and I was like, good God. Like, I mean, my machine, my old machine only has a 6,000 RPM spindle too. And so like, I think I do things in the way that I learn, and I'm probably like feeds and speeds. I'm probably running like 70% or 50% sometimes, like just because, you know, like one piece workflow on a folder, like the speed wasn't like the main thing. A good part was the main thing.
Yeah. Not scrapping a part is worth a lot on titanium and stuff.
Yeah. Exactly. With like little tiny end mills. And then it's like, oh, I, you know, broke it when the part's almost finished and now it's scrapped. Like, so yeah, it's all learning. Mm-hmm. Still, dude, I still think like the Sile current plan for us is basically we're trying to figure out a time to shut down to move the TM1 over to the new shop, right? So new shop is running with the Haas, but it's an island. I've only got that one machine. And so when I'm over there running, there's not much else that I can be doing other than like computer work. Mm-hmm. And so the plan is to get the other machine moved. Then we run into, here's a great one for you. Okay. Strategy question. Okay. Right now I have one Kayser compressor. Okay. The shop that I bought came with like this super old beat up, like standard. Piston. Yeah. Piston, like leaky, but it was there and it was plumbed. And so my plan was like, okay, I'll get the machine running, knowing that this is like a very temporary scenario.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So I have two options. I move my Kayser to the new shop, and that sets up the CNC machines. Okay. Mm-hmm. That leaves the finishing shop or custom shop without a compressor. Okay. I can buy an inexpensive compressor to run this shop if I don't have a CNC with air requirements. And at that point, like I'm also dealing with maybe some moisture issues and stuff for blasting.
Mm-hmm.
Or I just buy a new Kayser compressor and put it at the other shop.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's an age-old question there.
Right? They're not inexpensive.
So
12, probably 10 or 12 grand for the new Kayser.
Yeah.
I could probably get a compressor that would run this shop for two.
Mm-hmm.
But at some point, I probably need another Kayser or comparable.
Yeah. It's so. Are you going to be doing sandblasting in the new shop?
Yes.
Like short term, long term.
I would guess long term. So I'm essentially trying to make that shop self supporting
mm-hmm.
for like whatever product line comes out of it. Right. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That will also for now be where all the machining on anything happens, custom or otherwise. But it is, the goal would be to like, you know, for Kihoku to basically be able to be made in that shop.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So aside from trenching an underground pipe from your one shop to your other shop,
going aside, overhead, go across the
the just power string lines. It up. Yeah. I mean, if you use like PEX pipe, you just wrap it around the power line, go all the way over.
Yeah, that's perfect. That's fine.
Yeah.
It's Dakota.
Aside from that, in my experience, the machines use a small amount of air as far as capacity, unless you're hard milling with air blast. That would be the exception. And this, where the sandblasters are, is where the best and most valuable compressor should be if you have only one.
Right.
So I could totally see the case where if you're going to have sandblasting on both sides, you eventually are going to need air drying and a large capacity CFM compressor on both sides.
Yeah.
But if you were to not have a blast cabinet in the new shop for a while and just the machines, I would probably get an inexpensive piston until that day comes, that because it's really the sandblasting that is where the compressor needs to be. It seems that
Siles use less air than a Haas, I think. Do I Could remember be. That? Because you're not like air, you're not air tool changes.
They are.
They are.
The air power drawbar
Okay.
And an air cylinder is what extends the carousel as
Okay.
well. And then it's got a purge for chip cleaning when the taper is about to go
so
on the tool.
Moisture is the other one. And this is where I'm like, dude, I have this love hate with Kayser, where it's like, they are expensive, but they're so good. And then there's, at this point, I was like, well, maybe I could do like a different brand, spend half. But what I realized is, like, at a point, I'm like, for maintenance to come, if I need maintenance on it, like, this is the same question, right? Where it's like, if I have one tech come out to work on the first Kayser, I can have them work on both, and that's like cheaper.
Oh, I could totally. I think the case for two Kaysers makes a lot of sense.
Makes more sense than two different. Yeah. You don't run into moisture issues without an air dryer.
We have an air dryer.
You do have an air dryer.
Yeah. So we have
a piston.
We have an Ingersoll Rand. It's like a, about one of the biggest like piston compressors that you'll typically see. We have like a three phase, big, you know, 120 gallon piston compressor that's really nice, and it's hooked up to an air dryer as a secondary thing. It's not like part of the compressor, and that works really good. And part of it is, my big thing with I eventually want to buy a screw compressor,
right?
That would be ideal, but the thing about this one is, in this shop we have literally another room, and I can't really hear the piston compressor. If
that's
I
a big, so that's
it,
another big, that's another big component, which is my shops are small. And so that's like the, basically the only compressor I think that I would go with, it's really weird, but California Air Tools make really quiet piston compressors. Our buddy Keaton has one, Watchmaker Keaton. It's quiet. Like, it might even be quieter than my screw compressor.
And another thing you can do, and maybe they already have it on that, is a lot of the noise from a piston compressor comes from the air intake, which is usually like a little air filter with a little tube. If you put like a rubber hose on it and run it into like another almost suppressor, like run it into like a bucket or something with like a bunch of holes, a ton of the sound is coming straight out of the tube where the intake, where the air is coming in. And so remotely having an air intake reduces it doesn't reduce the like rumble, but like that high pop, higher frequency sounds,
the whine.
Yeah. A lot of them come right out of the intake.
Okay. So here's the bigger question then. Okay. Kayser can be financed, and because it's not a huge expense, the payment is pretty minimal. Okay. What do you think that Ingersoll Rand and air dryer combo costs?
So it was already in the shop. Steven was in the shop before us, and he bought all that stuff for Cerakote is why he bought it. And then now we have bought out the Cerakote. So now it is ours, but I didn't. So it's probably, it was probably like, if I had to guess for the package for the two, it's probably like $3,500, $4,000. Yeah, okay.
Something like that. And is it an Ingersoll Rand dryer also?
No, I forget the brand. It's a different brand.
Yeah. I might ask you that later then.
Yeah.
Yeah, dude, this is the kind of stuff right now. Like, this is small business, like prime, like where when you grow elements of a business, like cash flow starts to become trickier just because it's like, okay, we're spending more over here, but this part hasn't started to bring in like enough revenue to like offset it. Or if it has brought in enough revenue, it's not always like in phase. You know, it's like the bills are due before the money is in. And so this is stuff like scaling that I'm learning that is not, this is like where knife makers like struggle a lot of times.
So what about this? How do you feel capacity wise about the compressor you already have over there? The old crusty one.
We'd probably underutilize this compressor. The cool thing about the Kaysers though, also, is like, they don't have like, this is like a thing that I did a deep dive on, and I'm probably, I'm years out from when I did the deep dive. But what I remember is like certain screw types, they almost have like a minimum amount that they have to run.
Yes. I've heard that as well.
The Kaysers do not have that.
Hmm.
So the Kaysers, like, they can be on demand or they can run 100% duty cycle.
Yeah. Yeah. That's cool.
So if we're blasting and running the CNC and someone's doing something with air, like we have plenty of air. It's like,
nice.
I don't know, I want to say like 25 CFM.
That's a lot.
At 100% duty cycle.
Yeah.
So you could just lights
that's
out.
That's a lot.
Yeah.
And then, but the compressor at the new shop, is your main issue that you don't trust it, or is it that you don't have
it? Oh, I fully air? Don't trust it.
Okay.
It's like, so, I can like, I'm like looking at it and I'm like, okay, there's a lot of oil areas. And I'm like, I'm pretty sure I hear like a wheeze that isn't associated with like an airline.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's just, and it's, I mean, it's like, it's big. It's probably 120 gallon or more.
Yeah.
And old, and it's outside.
So, devil's advocate.
Yep.
Change the oil on it, put an air filter on it, run a remote hose to the intake real quick.
Mm-hmm.
Buy an air dryer for like $900, run the air through it, and then come back to that when everything else is running. Because
it's
hard to replace a working compressor, and there's the risk of it going down. But if you need to run, let's say, one machine, a $180 Harbor Freight compressor will run a machine.
Yeah.
So if you already have the air dryer and you just need to run to Home Depot real quick, it's pretty easy to bail yourself out.
I need to look at remote air dryers as far as a solution.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. That's a good take. Yeah. Sometimes, dude, I get in these modes where I'm just like, I don't like to spend money if I know I'm going to like replace a piece of equipment quickly, but mm-hmm. they are consumables. And so like that is very valuable.
Well, and the air dryer, dude, could be worth something, because even if you went and bought a Kayser and you still have this air dryer, it's worth it. Worth something in resale. But also, if you have enough airlines running through your shop, like you could argue you could have redundancy on the air dryer. Like you could totally,
by the time you get to blast cabinets, or like, for instance, like Cerakote.
Yeah. You could have a dedicated air dryer,
right at the room or whatever it is.
Yeah. So it's just that it's not like lost money, because all you're buying is just the dryer.
Right. So right now, I guess right now the risk is I lose. Main compressor goes down. That's easily replaceable. But I'm also dealing with the fact that I know that I'm not giving the machine good air. That's fine for a couple of weeks or a month, but I don't want to do it the rest of the year.
Yeah. Air dryers.
So air dryer. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. I'll look at remote air dryers.
Okay. Yeah. No, last I checked, they're, you know, $1,000 plus or minus $200.
Okay. That's a good take. I like that. Yeah, dude, this stuff is really interesting. Just the areas where you have to kind of rethink known scripts. I've told you a little bit about OMAP, right? That I've mentioned that.
OMAP. Oh yeah. Oregon Manufacturing
something. Extension Program.
Yeah.
Okay. So we basically got a grant to work with this group OMAP, whose purpose is to like help small manufacturing businesses kind of like scale and or kind of refine. And so the way I've been working with them, this guy comes in once a week and we spend about 3 hours, and it's kind of started on the financial side, which makes sense. A lot of what they do is kind of around lean manufacturing. And so it's been interesting though, because as he's come in, the initial thing that we kind of have realized is like scaling for us right now doesn't necessarily mean scaling output. It means scaling in a way that frees up my time to be more valuable to the like growth of the business moving forward.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's pretty cool, but I mean, it's such a different people that have a background in business in general, but then in manufacturing, like it is a different thought process than a lot of, I think, what we do or like how we set things up. You might ride like a middle line because of just what you've seen and like the way you've structured your business. But I would say like on like the like custom side, most of us struggle pretty hard when we try to like move into any kind of production.
I should look into the Idaho side of that. I wouldn't, I mean, especially in the Boise area, there might be something similar in terms
Dude,
of,
well, here, look at this. So this, and this is maybe the big takeaway for me, which is around like local network. That is something that I never really worked on because I didn't do sales locally. You know, New Mexico, I didn't sell knives like locally, really. I would go to shows, you know, same when we moved to the Cape. This all came about because someone from OSU reached out about the potential for us to take an intern. They came and toured. Everything looks good. Interns still come at a price, right? And you have to have a place to put them and like some kind of like or organized like project, right? OSU put us in touch with this group, OOA. Sorry if this is hard to track, which is Oregon Outdoor Alliance. They were going to pay for the intern for us through a
Wow.
grant that they get. Their job is basically to network and help businesses in Oregon that are based in the outdoor industry.
Yeah, that's
Bend
cool.
has a lot of them. Okay. But they needed to place an intern by the beginning of October. We weren't in a position to do that. They put us in touch with OMAP. And the OMAP is like, it's like an $11,000 grant for consulting. And it just kind of was like, wow, like all those avenues are still open. I now have like resources at OSU where I can, they have, dude, they have engineering, they have product design for the outdoor industry, they have graphic design, they have accounting, and all of those groups need to be able to place interns.
Yeah,
Huge,
that's huge.
tied in with Oregon Outdoor Alliance. They do like networking events and same kind of thing, right? Like they put us in touch with OMAP. Like we don't know the resources that we need or have
Yeah,
access to sometimes.
yeah. But you got to lay the groundwork for that when that day comes, you know? That's a great point. And we're pretty close to a university,
That was
Boise.
my thought,
So,
right?
yeah, I should utilize that more. I did go there, so
I mean, dude,
yeah.
and that's a, I don't know. I think at least in my case, like a lot of times I have imposter syndrome about like one being an adult and then two being like a real business.
Yeah.
And it was cool
Yeah,
when
same.
OSU came and they were like, oh no, this is great. They're like, this is like a perfect place for a student to come. It's
Yeah.
like,
Yeah.
really?
That isn't it. Interesting. I have this similar feeling. It's like, what do you mean if I have an intern? It's like I thought I was the intern.
Yeah,
You know what
like I'm
I
still
mean?
in that mode where like I still feel like the student, you know? But dude, I mean, how rad would it be to just pull in an engineering student, right? But also for them, like we do so many different things and we do it differently and we have to make decisions quickly. I mean, there's other businesses that do similar kind of flow of manufacturing, but I mean, it's pretty fun. Like, there's worse places to go intern,
Yeah, I know.
you
Yeah,
know?
it's that is a major benefit to what we've chosen as an industry
Yeah.
is the question, do you want to make knives, is
Yeah.
has a little bit of weight, seems
Yeah.
to me.
Well, and
Yeah.
especially like, dude, in Boise, like, we're talking about like, you know, hunting. Like, how many kids are hunting right now? You know? Are you still working with your advisor?
I'm not.
Okay, so you kind of
Yeah.
like wrapped that as a
Yeah,
cycle.
we did a full year, and he's a great asset. I mean, he's been in executive positions all around the place. He's retired now. He's doing this in retirement, and the big thing that I wanted for that year to have him on board was on the financial side of the business, a real business, and we are a corporation now and all that.
Right.
A real business needs to have legitimate reporting on profit and loss statements,
Right.
balance sheets, cash flow management.
Yep.
And I did not feel like I had a really strong hold on that. And I wanted someone who has looked at these for a lifetime of, you know,
Yeah.
actually interpreting them. He's not an accountant per se. But I felt like having him on as opposed to an accountant helping you generate proper reporting, he's looking at the reporting from the other side and saying, this is how you need to format it. Because what I learned is there's a lot of subjective decisions in how you lay out like a profit and loss. There's obviously things that are critical from like a tax standpoint that are not subjective.
Right.
But there's a lot of it that's like how you categorize things, cost of goods sold versus not. You know what I mean? Like there is some gray area in how you want to set it up. So he helped me get all of our reporting to where every month we were doing these reports. And it allowed me to have the real analytics, because it's like net profit, gross profit, owner distributions versus owner salary, you know what I mean? All this stuff. And so I feel like I understand the business. And if I were to talk to like a business person that does this in a real way, I could have that conversation. And so that was what I hired him for. And we kind of got to the point where it felt like that was mature.
Yep.
And that was about a year of just kind of materializing all that. And so, yeah.
So this is funny, dude. That's literally what I'm doing with Shane right now. Is we started at a balance sheet and a P&L. And just are refining it. It's like all the information is there for taxes. But when he looks at it, he's like, here are the questions that I have. Right. Like, I don't know what this means. And just like minor tweaks, like we were talking about, like, production costs. And basically he's like, why are there no labor costs in like cost of goods sold?
Yeah.
And I mean, totally valid question, but like, I've just like, I don't know how to break that down. A team of
robots that do it all.
Right. Yeah. No. But he's like, okay. He's like, Isaiah is shop, right? And I was like, yeah. He's like, okay. So when you manufacture product, Isaiah's included in that. Yeah. So we need, it's been really cool. So now he's like, I'm like working with him and my accountant to like, just kind of restructure P&L. And with exactly what you said, which is if you went to somebody and were like, whatever it is, you want an investor, you want a loan, you want them to be able to look at your P&L and understand what the business is actually doing.
And if they ask you a question, you need to be able to answer it.
You need to be able to answer it. And this is like slow leveling up of business where, you know, you realize like, I am not a businessman. I am a man who is doing business. They are different. Yeah, dude, that's funny that's essentially, I mean, I guess it's where like you start at the beginning.
Yeah. Yeah.
For and us, that's probably the beginning.
Hugely important, because once I had what are my gross margins? What are my net margins? Then you can start to like, I would go to ChatGPT and be like,
yeah,
okay, I'm going to describe my whole business. And that, you know, ChatGPT is not the gospel. Cross-reference, obviously. Yep. But like, I type in, this is the type of business we sell direct to customer. We do this. We do this. We manufacture in-house. What do you think is a good target gross margin and net margin with these constraints? And it gave me like a bell curve of like, this is kind of what you might like to see for those percentages. And I could go try to cross-reference that. But obviously, no business is the same, because some just different models have totally different targets for those percentages. But it was able for me to like set some goalposts in a real way, because there's a tendency when you don't have all that information to just set revenue goals.
Right.
And revenue is,
it doesn't matter. It's like, it matters. It's a
number of almost no meaning.
Right.
It can be like impressive at the outset, but you know, these margin percentages are the targets, not the revenue. That's a parallel or, you know, secondary concern.
Yeah.
So,
But those are like, those are the lessons. It's like, you don't know the questions to ask.
Yeah.
If you didn't go to business school, like there's a good chance you don't know that.
Yeah.
You know, it's pretty cool, man. I thought you would get a kick out of this. So we're like working through all this, and there was, I have two questions that I think are kind of like relevant. One, after the first like 3 hour session, my ears were kind of smoking, and I'm like, I'm feeling self-conscious and like looking at my like rickety business and, you know, all this stuff. And I'm like, in of the businesses that you see that are kind of comparable, I was like, how many of them are struggling with the same thing that I am? And like, without missing it, he's like, 90%.
Yeah. You know?
And he said, he was like, woodworkers. He's like, right now, looking at what you're doing, he's like, I feel like woodworkers are the closest approximation. He's like, of what I see, which is you have like a furniture designer who starts to scale, make more pieces. He's like, they're dealing with all the same things you're dealing. They're dealing with like going to automation. They're dealing with like managing employees. And they were someone who just really liked building furniture.
Yeah. Yeah.
So he's like, it's really, really common. The other thing is I was like, I asked him what his background was. This guy is like, he's super even keeled, really genuine. Like he's delightful to have in the shop, but he was an F-16 pilot. And he's like, yeah, I don't have a background in manufacturing. He's like, I have a background in process.
Yeah.
He's like, if you are a pilot, he's like, you learn the process and you have to be able to teach the process and you have standards and you have like, he's like, all of this applies to manufacturing. And I thought that was pretty cool.
Yeah. I think that's valid. Yeah. So, that sounds interesting.
Yeah, dude, it's exciting. I mean, like this is, you know, from the business side, like you don't know like the next thing you're going to learn. And it's really easy to focus on what we make, super important. And how much we make, also important. But like you just said, like being able to look at your business and understand like the numbers, it's a different thing than just like, oh, we did this much revenue last year.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And one of the things he told me early on is he said almost everyone that he works with in the beginning thinks they're making more money than they are. And so that's the first thing you have to dispel is like, oh, you had this number in your head because you're like, well, I have this much revenue and I have probably about this much profit. It seems like he's like, you have to know that number. You cannot just feel like you know that number. You know what I mean? Because there are things on the downhill side of those profit and loss and balance sheets and stuff that are like, you know, you have accrued interest, you have depreciation, like you have to factor these things in and you have to really get to the nuts and bolts of like, how much are you making? Because if you're going to work and you have a W-2, you know how much you make. You can answer the question. You need to be able to answer it that certainly as well in the business. You need to be able to do that. And that's a rare thing for someone who has not been trained or has looked into this with great detail.
Or might not have like, I'm not like a numbers driven person. Like I'm not diving into data a lot of times. And so, but this is the whole point, right? Which is you support areas of your skill set with other skill sets. You support areas of your business where you may not have knowledge with other knowledge. And then it starts to like blend and you see like why people that have been in business for 40 years, it's like, they know a lot because they've made a lot of mistakes. Yeah. They've had to go through. I am currently reading a book that I will recommend.
Okay.
This is called Finish Big by Bo Burlingham. And it's basically, maybe we'll have no direct like effect on any, like I will probably maybe not sell my business. So it's basically a book on how entrepreneurs exit their business. What's cool about it is that it essentially is that we all exit at some point in some, if you start a business, you will exit that business, right?
Yeah.
You'll sell it, you'll close it, you'll hand it down to a kid, you'll liquidate machinery, your body will stop working, can't do it. And this book is essentially that process of like thinking about it in a way of like being able to at some point versus it being forced upon you. And it's that same thing of like best practices. It's like, if you build a business in a way that it could be sold, your business is working well.
Yeah.
Everything is in order. You like, so we're talking about it at a really basic level, which is like, if you understand your books, that's part of that process.
Yeah. Yeah,
pretty
that's
interesting, dude.
it is. Yeah, I got a lot of value out of it. And him and I are going to stay in touch. And I think the way I was kind of looking at it in the future is bring him in for moments of large decision, perhaps. But it felt like we'd kind of stabilized, and it was kind of getting to where the point of diminishing returns on perfecting those profit and loss statements and whatnot. So there's always more to learn, but it's critical. And I
It's
highly recommend
critical.
people studying that because it's actually kind of fun once you start to figure it out, because those numbers did not exist in your mind. Maybe you could speculate, but once you actually know them, it becomes very interesting to me, because
Yeah,
you can
it
look
is.
over.
Once you understand enough, that's always I always say that I love being bad at things, which is not, it's not, that's not correct. I love being at the point where I have enough skill to do a thing poorly, maybe, but to understand like what I'm doing, like where you can start to have fun in that process. Yeah, I don't know. You know, it's funny, man, just like thinking about the flow of this conversation. I'm sure that we've like jumped out of people's interest zones like at least three times in some area of it. But that's the nature, I think, of this business. Definitely of this, like why we have these conversations. Yeah, dude, I don't know. Kind of funny. We never know where they're going to go. Like,
Yeah,
you
I
don't know
know.
that we're going to end up talking about accounting at the end when we started talking about hunting in the beginning.
Yeah, I know it.
Like,
Yeah, that is, I love it though. That's great.
yeah, hopefully you guys, I don't know, found some, at least a section of that was interesting. I think like takeaway right now is like try, like if you can build your network can help you understand things that maybe you don't know that you need to know.
Yeah, that's for
And that
sure.
there's resources out there to like, you know, kind of support that.
Yeah, just ask. That's
Just ask.
the thing.
Yep. Should we wrap it, man?
Yeah,
We
that feels good.
feel good.
Yeah, you
All
need to go
right.
dig a trench anyway, so.
I'm gonna go crawl across the power lines.
Yeah.
Dude. Okay. All right, man. You guys, thank you for listening. Give us a like, give us a follow, and we'll see you around.
Thank you guys. Peace.